مهاتما جي's body.
القناة اللي بتقع في أرض مصر.
Mr. President.
Never, never, and never again.
I have a dream.
Imogen
Lam. Hello, Voices Today welcomes Noah Samara, founding director of World Space, the world's first satellite radio. Noah Samara was born in 1956 in Addis Ababa to a Sudanese father and an Ethiopian mother. He left Ethiopia in the early 70s as the political situation there became more and more unstable and went first to Britain, then the United States, where he studied, then embarked on a career that focused on satellite technology. But in the mid-1980s, he read a newspaper article that was to change his life. It was a story about HIV/AIDS in Africa and how it was spreading because Africans had no information about the disease or were given the wrong information. Inspired to do something that could help inform about AIDS, he came up with the idea of launching a satellite over Africa that would broadcast digital radio across the continent, covering remote rural areas where people had no access to radio, newspapers or television. In 1990, he resigned from his job and began raising funds for the launch of World Space. The radio now covers Africa, the Middle East and Europe, and broadcasts some 200 channels with a very wide range of programming. While Noah Samara has received considerable support for his novel idea, he feels more could have been done to help him reach those people he says need World Space most. Reporter Daniel Brown met him at his headquarters in Washington, D.C. and was shown around the control room, where he asked Noah Samara whether World Space has made a difference.
It's very difficult for us to be able to assess that in terms of the types of information we've delivered, the numbers of people that have listened, but we have done as much as we possibly could, but we haven't had the kind of natural help you would expect from, you know, organizations like the World Bank, from organizations like, you know, UNDP, UNAIDS. You would think that organizations like that would use our system to actually deliver information to people on a continental level.
What explains that?
What explains it is pure bureaucratic lethargy. We have done an amazing, amazing, amazing work in delivering a system that covers 5 billion people that are living in 130 countries, most of which are affected by HIV/AIDS in one form or another. But we cover every inch of the territory of Africa, for example. And in Africa, HIV/AIDS arguably has killed anywhere from 17 million to 25 million people over the last decade of the 20th century. And at the beginning of the decade, which is really when I read about this article in the Washington Post, was really around the late 80s, early 90s, the prediction was about 5 million people will die in Africa. And I thought, wow, that's Holocaust proportion. And the world is really anti-Holocaust. And, you know, with that kind of, you know, angst and anger about that, my assumption was, wow, if I could just envision the system, people will be piling over each other to give me the money to make this thing, you know, go all the way. But it didn't happen. It didn't happen, and literally 25 million people have died, and the world has watched, even though I have cried like a, you know, a voice in the wilderness, banged on many doors, it felt like a story written by Kafka.
Noah Samara, you were very much the catalyst between these actors because you yourself are not a specialist, for example, in satellite technology, and there you had to lean towards the engineers from companies like Alcatel. I'd like to move away temporarily from World Space towards you yourself, and for that I'd like to leave this control room of World Space and move back into your office so that we get to know a bit more the man behind this unique adventure called World Space.
With pleasure.
It So Noah Samara, we're comfortably installed in your office here on the ninth or the eighth floor, I think it is, of this building, enjoying some very rare Chinese tea. And I did want to take a step back from what we were discussing upstairs in your control room. You were born of a Sudanese father and an Ethiopian mother, and your first 12, 13 years were in Addis Ababa. What elements of those formative years helped shape your world vision?
Those years were very interesting years in Africa. Those were the years when the OAU would be established. Those were the years when, you know, many African countries would find their independence. Those were the years when the Emperor of Ethiopia helped lead some of these efforts in emancipation. Those were the years when things were happening, and as a child, you know, sometimes things would be all lit up because, you know, there would be one flag or another flag. But I do particularly remember the establishment of the OAU. I remember that. I think I was like about, I must have been 5, 6, 7 years old.
And it was the early 60s, I think, 62
or something. Yeah, and my father had taken me down to see, you know, the city was just alive. The streets were lit like what we now see in Christmas and in holidays, and you see that in Paris and in major cities. But in Addis, it was just a unique thing. And there were flags, flags galore, and there were like heads of states coming in. The roads were blocked. It was both a time of hope and ultimately a time of descending series of disappointments. Because later on then, you know, after all of those years when I was six, and that time of expectation of something wonderful that's about to happen for all of us, and everybody was so excited. My parents were, I didn't know what they were talking about, but they were on the shortwave radios listening every night and arguing and talking about this and having all kinds of conversations. And then from that, you know, I remember like solemn nights where they were also cuddled across a radio listening to the war in Biafra. Just things that were happening that were not consistent with that picture. And later on, obviously, we would, you know, things just got worse in the 60s. And then finally, you know, Africa that had this great hope would ultimately then just have, you know, each one of these countries like Ghana, like Egypt, like Nigeria, all of these various countries, Kenya, that had such promise at the beginning. And actually now we know they had better balance of trade and they sold their products at better prices during the colonial years, obviously because the colonizers were selling it to each other. Everything was just deteriorating.
Noah, why did your parents send you off to Britain to finish off your education with A-levels in this tiny location, village in the Midlands?
In part, I think they wanted to get me out. After I went to Tanzania, I met a lot of people and I began to read. Between the age of 13 and the age of 16, I believe I just like read quite a lot. I was influenced by a lot of people. There was a lot of also very high intelligent, very politically active African Americans that had moved away from the U.S. because of the, you know, the death of Martin Luther King, because of the death of Robert Kennedy, the death of Malcolm X, and so forth. That had been disappointed and came to Tanzania. So we had a lot of people that we were talking to, and I was actually friends with some of these people, and I would get to read books by, you know, from James Baldwin to
Edridge Cleaver
to Bobby Seale and stuff like, you know, about the Black Panther movements and all these various major books, and then got into Frantz Fanon and stuff, you know. So it was just really heady times. Went back and really began to get politically active in Ethiopia. It was at the time when students were beginning to clamor for change of the emperor, and I was sort of part of, or wanting to be part of that. And it was just literally at the cusp of the time that the emperor was removed in 1974. And literally that summer is when I finished high school. And I asked my parents if I could stay there because history was being made. Can I be a part of this? This is really exciting. Can I stay a year longer and so forth? And my dad just said, no, you're getting out of here. And there was the school, a grammar school in the middle of nowhere in England, in Leicestershire. Called Ashby de la Zouche, beautiful place actually. And I went there and I went to do my A-levels there.
And that was where you read a book that you say transformed your vision, and that was The Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Why?
I think what that book did is it gave me an insight on human psychology like nothing ever would. And I think that book was an amazing influence on me, not so much in necessarily doing what it was that I wanted to do, but in terms of learning also the fact that Dostoevsky started writing his first major works when he was 19 years old. He knew, and I was, 19, and I was saying, wow.
By then you'd arrived to the United States. You actually got here when you were 17 years old, knowing little about what your destiny was to be. Your academic career was a brilliant one, however, with a law degree, a doctorate in Renaissance studies, and another degree in international business. Then you became an expert on regulatory issues. We're leaping ahead here. And a specialist on satellite and cellular communications and industry for developing countries. Why decide to devote yourself to these studies?
In a sense, I didn't know all of the things. Looking back, I know I made absolutely the right choices, but I would be foolhardy to tell you that I knew where I was going and therefore I made these choices. I think the choices I made were good only because I was honest in that I didn't know what I wanted to do. And for as long as possible, I didn't want to decide. I thought I wanted to learn about Renaissance and Reformation in Europe, in large part because I wanted to see a Renaissance in Africa. I was so disappointed about what was happening on the continent, but I thought that the only way to solve the problem of the continent was at a pan-African level, not at a single African by African country kind of level, but literally at a pan-African level.
Which was following a bit Nkrumah's dream.
To some extent, Nkrumah's dream, to some extent, other dreams that have been dreamt for the continent, but also just to follow the natural geography of the continent. We have all these man-made abstractions we call boundaries that suppress the reality of the continent, and we just continue to suppress that reality, and we are in love with the differences between a Kenyan and a Tanzanian. They both speak, Swahili. We're in love with the differences between an Eritrean and a man from Tigray. We're in love with the differences. We focus on differences. We focus on differences between a Moroccan and a Zimbabwean. Yes, there are huge differences. But, 85% of the gene of the Moroccan and 85% of the gene of the Zimbabwean actually came from Ethiopia. 85% of every person on this planet has the same genes as everybody else. And so to me, I think the Renaissance was interesting because, Africa, as far as I'm concerned, was in the Dark Ages and, to some extent remains in the Dark Ages. We need a Renaissance there. But how to do it? What happened in Europe? So that was sort of the question. I was a PhD candidate. I actually did not complete it and then went on to study law because I thought, I got to become more practical. And when I studied law, I found out about satellites, the law of outer space, all of that kind of stuff, And I said, maybe there's something here. And I started studying about that. Then at one point I read about this article that we talked about.
In the Washington Post on the AIDS victims.
And then you say, wow, satellites, information on HIV/AIDS, indeed information on a whole bunch of other things, on education, on how can we enlighten people? Why don't we find a way of, in a ubiquitous way, delivering information to lots of people? Wow, if we could do that, we have really invented the Gutenberg press, the printer. And that's it. This is the solution. The solution is to empower people. The solution is to inspire people, to educate them, to entertain them, to connect with them. And literally, it's only through that we will ultimately arrive at the solution. And I thought this would be a much better thing to do, even if I fail, than do something that would be just, I become a lawyer, I represent, some company X on how to get its taxes, not to pay taxes in Cameroon, or what's in a life like that?
We're listening to Voices with Noah Samada, the Ethiopian-Sudanese-American founder of World Space and its satellite radio technology. Noah, you had a successful career with Geostar Corporation and then a Washington law firm. How easy was it to give it all this up at the age of 34 and plunge into this unheard of dream of creating a satellite radio?
It was both difficult and easy. I believe actually when I decided to do this, I had my first daughter. And I just love children, period. And of course, when Layla was born, I was just crazy, like just totally rediscovered love. And it was just an amazing moment. And so it was only like I think I would say about 60 days after she was born that I decided to quit all the security that you described and go into this, you know, uncharted path. And I thought it was, however, something I really, really wanted to do. I thought I would have, like my soul would die. I would live, my body would live, but my soul would die if I didn't do something that just really meant something. It wasn't so important that I succeeded. What was important was that I did everything I could in making it happen. Sort of, you know, like the way you climb a hill. You know, you don't climb a hill on a bicycle by looking at the top of the hill. It's just so daunting. It kills you. On the other hand, if you just look down and you focus on the pedal and then the next pedal and then the next pedal, almost no hill is insurmountable.
You launched or helped launch the First Voice International and the Africa Learning Channel in 1999. It was to try and bring into existence this dream of yours that you've harbored of a kind of giant megaphone in the sky, beaming down programs on health, women's rights, children's rights, promoting peace and good governance, good business ethics also, etc. What challenges have you met in the 9 years that this radio station has existed?
You know, for the last 9 years, we have had something like 4, 5, 6 people max at First Voice International scrambling with little bit of money. And these people have been reaching something, you know, in the millions, reaching audiences in the millions with the best content that they could muster up. You know, how much can 5 people do? For the last 9 years, it's just been, again, you know, one struggle after another to get corporations to come in and put in, you know, millions of dollars behind something like this and say, you know, it's worth it. It's worth it. Let's go, let's use this system to educate people. Let's use this free capacity to reach people and tell stories and through stories, advance, inspire, educate Africans. Let them, you know, let people in Zimbabwe know what women in Mali are doing to put extra food on the table. All of this kind of thing can be done in a very coordinated way if we have a view of the continent. The problem that we have right now is we have a very segmented view of the continent that creates mental barriers where none should be. You know, my hope is someday that it sounds corny, but it's really like John Lennon's song, you know, you may say I'm a dreamer, but you know, I'm not the only one. There's people out there who are asking, you know, not why am I here? That's they don't even go there. As this young Sudanese girl once wrote a poem that said, they're not asking why, but when.
Noah Samara, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, sir.
Voices was produced for Radio France International by Daniel Brown with studio manager Ariane Gaffury. Our email, voices@rfi.fr. Bye for now. Our brotherhood.